Welcome to not just another episode of the River of Suck podcast. For episode 36, we've got the one and only Melody Walker. I am your host, Andy Reiner, checking in before we get started. This episode contains expletives. This episode is unbleepable. If strong language is likely to offend your sensibilities, just close your eyes and everything will be fine. If you're offended by swear words, maybe pick another episode, but be sure to check out Melody Walker's music on Spotify or wherever you listen. Okay, that's the red tape. Let's go! We're centered. We're here.
I'm still recording. Okay, we got it.
Yeah, perfect.
All right, sweet. Commence interview. How do you usually start these things?
Like this.
Okay.
Actually, usually I talk about food before anything else happens.
Okay, great. Perfect. Just had an incredible breakfast of, do you really want to, you want to know? I had one of those musician 1 p.m. breakfasts.
Oh, yeah.
of bacon and some stewed collard greens we had left over and some, like, gold potatoes that were baked in the oven with like Szechuan pepper on them, and then like one of those kind of Asian fried eggs with like the crispy bottom, you know what I mean? Yeah.
Welcome to the River of Suck podcast, Melody. Yes. Walker, you're in Nashville, Tennessee, right?
I am.
You're a Nashville songwriter.
I technically am a Nashville songwriter. I sort of have taken that mantle with pride. Just fake it till you make it, you know?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Right off, fake it till you make it. I have opinions on that phrase, you know, fake it till you make it. I'm trying to replace it with do it until you're doing it. Because if you're doing it, are you really faking it?
Exactly. No, that's a great way. That's a great way to see it. But I do think with like titles, it can feel very fake it till you make it when you're like, ooh, bona fide Nashville songwriter, Melody Walker.
Did you feel like some kind of imposter syndrome? What do you have to do to become a Nashville songwriter if you're writing songs and you're in Nashville?
I think it's pretty simple. My definition of it is just if you've ever, you know, written or co-written a song that somebody else besides you, anybody else besides you has recorded, you know? Because that's like the idea in Nashville, right? Is like writing songs and pitching songs. Although we can talk about how pitching songs is, it's not so much a thing these days. Most artists want to have a hand in writing their own material, even if they're one of five co-writers in the room, you know what I mean?
Nice. So yeah.
I feel like when I first moved to Nashville, I moved here with my band Front Country, and so it was mostly, I was fronting that band, I was the main songwriter, so it was mostly me writing songs for me to sing in my band. And that's, you know, being a songwriter for sure. But as far as being like a Nashville songwriter, that's a whole other thing. And I didn't start to explore that really till I started co-writing with my friends here in Nashville. And I was not a co-writer either before I moved here. All my experience with co-writing had sort of been in bands and groups that I was in. But it wasn't like very successful, honestly. It was usually kind of fraught and a little scary. And everybody had like so much writing on it, you know, and either whether it was ego or it was like, I just haven't written that many songs. And so every song is precious, you know, like people have this sort of scarcity mentality about songwriting sometimes. And so I really had to go through a whole journey of writing a lot of songs on my own, you know, writing 100 songs just by myself. And I think, I don't know if it's this way for everybody. Some people can probably start out co-writing, but that was just my path in life. That was the way that I needed to learn how to do it. I'm a very like headstrong kind of person who's like, you know, wants to be like, let me do it. I need to learn it myself. You know what I mean? So yeah, I had something to prove to myself, I think, that I could write songs that were like quote unquote good enough on my own. However, I don't know if it's because I'm just older and a better songwriter now and more experienced or because I started co-writing so much, but I feel like the songs that I've co-written in the past few years when I've really, really gotten heavily into co-writing, and I've now probably co-written about 100 songs with people. I feel like I'm writing the best songs of my life, and I do think that they are better for being co-written. I'm also writing better songs alone as well, but I think that I've learned so much from co-writing that's made my own solo songwriting better. I feel like when you put two heads together, you know, some people think that you might dilute a song in a way, but sometimes like dilution and dose is really important when you're talking about like medicine. If we want to just dive right into a metaphor here, you know, the dose, the concentration, the dilution, it matters. And I think that it can make a song really accessible if there are two people in the room who can resonate with it, who were able to find their way into it. So at least two people can understand what the song is and map them, their own experience onto it. And that's going to make it way more potentially accessible to other people who hear it and for it to resonate with them.
Yeah. Collaboration is just the ultimate dissolution of like how important your ego is, because I think it's more important to like be aware of the people around you than it is necessarily for it to be about one person in particular. When the thing that you're composing together is like, you know, a collaboration, it's just, it's so different. And I love hearing about that.
I think it's also like, I think in collaboration, it works the best when everybody not even is looking to each other, although you're obviously doing a lot of like deep awareness and listening. It's more about the lack of ego of having like a duty to this idea or this, you know, musical thing that you're conjuring together, right?
Cool.
And it's almost on a spiritual level that like if everybody's eye is on that prize, you know, that you're like trying to do what's best for the music and the song and the energy that you're trying to move in that space, then you can't really go wrong. But when people's egos get involved, then I'm aware of that ego and then my focus is off of the task at hand.
Whoa. Yeah, that's some crazy brain stuff. I mean, how do you consciously put your brain in the right place to get your ego out of the way?
I think there's a lot of things that help. I can't say that like having the right mindset is easy at all. I've had quite a journey in the last few years, kind of after my band sort of went on hiatus after 2020. I've been on a journey of like trying to find the joy in music again, trying to have my head in the right place and be my priorities straight as far as what makes music special to me and worthwhile, trying to basically keep the magic in it. And I think what helps with it is, number one, not having like a scarcity mentality about it. Like, there's always the next composition and the next composition, the next song. There's always another song. We don't have to get like all our great ideas into this one song and shoehorn them in, you know? And I feel like that's something that a lot of like young songwriters do. They're trying to shoehorn all the ideas in. And in fact, like distilling it down to just like one tiny, really good idea and fleshing that out is often the best way to get a great song that is like classic and timeless and gets across an idea. That's not to say that there's not room for songs like It's the End of the World as We Know It that are just a fucking laundry list, you know? Can I curse on this podcast, by the way? Yeah, so that's not to say there's not room for like stream of consciousness, like random songs with a million ideas in them, but that's kind of an idea in and of itself. It's like you're committing to that bit, you know?
Yeah.
And there's just always another song, so you don't have to get all the ideas in there for the sake of it. So that's a big one. Scarcity, you know, that's just like fear creeping into the process, which is like a type of ego too. You know, it's like, it's just illusion and ego, if you want to get spiritual about it.
I mean, you just connected all the dots. That's all of them.
I've been really trying to connect the dots the last couple years, dude, like really trying to like stay on target and know why I'm doing this and what makes it special, and to not kind of lose sight. I feel like I really lost sight for many years being in a band, a band that specifically was grinding within capitalism in the way that we thought that we needed to this is the trade that everybody makes, not just in music. Everybody makes this this trade because it's what we're sold in our society that, oh yeah, from like, you know, 25 to 35 or something, if you can just grind really, really, really hard, you'll have more time and freedom on the other end of that. If you just grind really hard and you win. And that is a friggin' illusion. And I know that there are people right now who are like 25 listening to this who are going to be like, yeah, sure. I mean, you can say that. They'll be like, I guess I sort of get that. But you're not going to get it until you do it and you try to buy the stupid lottery ticket. And then you realize that there's like only one or two winners, you know, and like it's set up to mostly milk all of us for our labor and exploit us. And get us to trade our very souls for this promise. It's not just like,
wow.
Here's what I think. I think when I was like 20, you know, I thought like selling out, quote unquote, was a thing you did with the music industry, right? I thought it was this thing, like this offer. Somebody's going to make you an offer you can't refuse. You know, like this Hollywood... Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. And that's what selling out like used to mean. I think like to a lot of people, there was like a thing, you get a record label deal and then you change your whole look and you change all your values and all that stuff. But it's a lot more insidious than that. All of us sell ourselves out to capitalism like every freaking day if we're not careful. And that is what selling out is. And no one ever told me that. And I'm not sure if they could have told me that exactly, you know, because I probably was stupid and I thought, no, it's going to be me, you know, but it can't be everybody. It's probably not you. There's so much luck and nepotism and privilege that goes into being the lucky lotto winner anyway. You can see a lot of bands, you know, the older I get, the further I get in this industry, the more I realize how much... Yes, talent matters, but talent plus privilege in a trust fund really gets you there. That's what'll get you there. And the people who stay in the game long enough, you know, even if it's just a game of holding in there, being the last man standing, even if it's just that game, what do you think buys you that time and ability? You know, having resources, having a trust fund, or maybe getting lucky. It used to be that bands maybe would get like a really good like sync placement early in their career or something, and then they could use that to build a touring career off of and buy them time to build their band. These days, sync placements don't pay what they used to unless it's like a whole song in a feature film that you wrote, you know, all that. But that's like, it's just few and far between. Like if you get an Apple commercial, that's going to set you up right. But if you just get some online ad or something, or even just in an indie film, it's going to be like a couple grand, you know, it's not going to be that much.
Yeah. I don't really know what selling out means anymore. Cause I'm like, am I selling out if I'm playing weddings and corporate events and it's covers and it's not my music and it's not, but then I'm like, well, I'm playing music with people that I love. I'm taking solos. I'm singing harmonies. Selling out doesn't feel so bad.
I think it's only selling out if it's not treating you well, like your musical soul, you know?
Oh, man.
If you have your reasons why you're doing it and you have good boundaries around it, that's the other thing. It's the boundaries really that'll get you, because capitalism doesn't want you to have boundaries, you know? So many people are out there working 40-hour work weeks that turn to 80-hour work weeks, you know? Yeah. And with musicians, it's like often when you're on tour, it's like 24 hours a day. On call.
It's the whole
driving through the night sometimes. Like,
yeah,
it's a whole thing. Partying with your hosts that are putting you up for free, like whatever it is, just never ends. And we are taught to not have good boundaries around that. And I think also being in the arts, we think we're special unicorns. Like, we're not like a real job. We're not like other jobs, you know? So we don't have to have like the rules and boundaries that people should have and that we probably would have if we had like a corporate job. But also we're all like these misfit toys who could never, you know, most of us. Like, I feel like the reason I'm doing this is because I probably couldn't like actually stand to have a job like that. And that's why I've been doing this continuously, you know, as an adult.
This is so great. I was wondering if you could share for anyone, especially who's new to the music and life of Melody Walker, if you could share your superhero origin story.
Well, I have my superhero origin story, but I also have my villain origin story too.
Whoa. I want both. I'm greedy, okay. And I want both.
So my superhero origin story, I'm definitely a songwriter because my dad is a songwriter. He's not a professional songwriter. He's just a dude who plays music in my hometown, his hometown. He works at a power plant by day. He really needs to fucking retire because it's killing him. He's so close. He should be retired, but I don't know why he's hanging in there. They kind of need him, I guess. He knows things. He knows too much. but my dad has always been a songwriter just by lifestyle, you know? And he's always played in local bands. He used to host the open mic in my hometown, which is really sweet. Wow. And now I'm kind of hosting a night similar to that in Nashville. And I have hosted open mics before. It's daughter, father, I guess. My mom's a big music fan too. And they took me to all kinds of concerts growing up. That's kind of what they spent their money on, you know, they still do. Yeah. They're big music people. You know, they probably go to as far as big ticketed shows, not just their little local hometown things at the local brewery and stuff. They go out to at least 20 concerts a year, and they always have since I was a kid. So I was so privileged to get to go see a lot of different types of bands, you know, everything from Bob Dylan and Paul Simon on tour and the Indigo Girls and when I started getting into the stuff I was into in middle school, my dad was down to take me to see Smashing Pumpkins was the first big show that I saw that was a band I wanted to see. And then he took me to see Nine Inch Nails and Tool.
My dad took me to see Nine Inch Nails.
Yes.
Nice.
Hell yeah. What tour was it?
Oh, I think remember? It might have been around the... The Fragile...
I think mine was the Fragile, Frail, or... Yeah.
It might have been before that. I feel like there wasn't a new album, because I remember the Fragile coming out, a couple years after that. They had, this is a sidetrack, but I don't know how you can have so... they practically have, 9 years between every one of their albums, so that's... Yeah. That's wild that they did that. Anyway.
So that's what I used to be into. I was into proggy metal stuff when I was a kid. I was really lucky to see all kinds of different music and a lot of local music and see my dad playing music and that him and his friends could play music. And also he was into bluegrass when I was growing up and he played bluegrass with his friends and they would always go to the Strawberry Music Festival in Yosemite and camp and pick. And so as a kid, I grew up at that festival. So very much I ended up, in a band that was playing those same types of festivals. Front Country got to play at Strawberry. We had a really great slot and it was great. It was a full circle moment.
Cool.
So that's definitely how I ended up doing what I'm doing today. And I honestly don't know how people do it who didn't have an example in their life of you can just be a songwriter. Anyone can be a songwriter. Because it is a really presumptuous thing to think you can do.
Yeah, I guess.
it really is, right? To have the audacity. And most people don't have the audacity. And when you explain to them, you just need the audacity. They're like, I don't know what you mean. And it's like, you just got to decide that you're allowed to do this. That's step one.
Yeah. The audacity to believe in yourself enough to start.
Yeah.
And then there's always editing. You can't edit nothing.
And to suck, right? That's what your whole podcast is about.
Right.
Giving yourself permission to suck.
For sure.
The advice that I give people is you just need to write your first 10 songs and know that they're going to suck, but that doesn't stop the fact that you have to write them with all your heart and try your hardest to not suck. But just know that they're going to suck, but you got to still try your hardest. And then by the 10th one, the 10th one will be not bad, honestly. As long as you really tried and you tried to complete 10 songs to your satisfaction, okay, this feels like a whole song that is, it has all the parts. It's at least like 2 minutes long or something. You know?
Oh, yeah.
And that you feel like you gave it your best try to complete the idea you were going for, you know? And that there will be totally. More songs. Always remember there's going to be more songs, right? And I think it helps people to be like, oh, okay, I just have to get past my first 10 songs and then my first 20 songs. And then like by the time I write 50 songs, as long as I tried my best and actually like really tried to do a good job, tried to explore and do a little better every time, like do yeah. something I hadn't tried yet every time, by the 50th song, you're going to be probably a good songwriter, honestly. Like 50 is a lot of songs.
No doubt. Hearing you say all that just now made me think about like a painter or something, where if you're making a painting, you have your canvas and you're basically going to fill it with whatever. But, you know, like you were saying earlier, the more focus you have for that one little piece of art, the better. You can't actually put everything into a painting. There's only so much space, and you can have details and big features, but I don't know if anyone, I mean, as someone who's not really a talented visual artist, it looks, from my perspective, it feels like each painting for a painter is just like, oh, it's another painting. Like there's always going to be another painting coming in. You don't have to put every single thing you know into that one painting. I don't know if this analogy makes any sense.
No, it makes sense. It's like on the one hand, you do have to like pour your entire soul into every yeah. piece of art that you make. But you also have to, it's almost like a Zen cognitive dissonance kind of dichotomy of like you're pouring your whole soul into it, like it yeah. matters the most, but it also doesn't fucking matter at all. It's like burn it, move on to the next one, and having that level of like detachment and understanding that it's about like the process, not the product, and like yeah. you're going through this process, but you have to do it with your whole heart. You can't phone it mm-hmm. in, you know. It has to be like earnest and honest to you, and yeah, you, and only you know. If you're being honest, if you're like doing it with integrity, if you're trying your dangdest to make it mean something to you.
Do it. Finish it. Move on.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice. Well, what about that supervillain origin story?
Oh,
does that
oh,
have
yeah,
to do
villain.
With is that have to do with the drag stuff and
that's part
the haters?
Of it, for sure. For sure. Okay. I think it started with
yeah.
I've always been like okay being a villain since I was a kid, because I've always like had a little evil streak to me.
I love it.
But I guess these days I try to describe it as chaotic good.
But, oh, yeah.
Okay. Hopefully good. Yeah, it, I don't know. A lot of people knew me from Bluegrass Shitposting.
Right.
Yep. Where, you know, it was just a great opportunity to sort of spoof the sexism and all the other bigotries that are sort of lurking in the bluegrass scene. Because if people don't know that scene, it's actually really pretty diverse as far as viewpoints and stuff. I would not say it's racially diverse. but as far as like political Oops. Leanings and stuff, there's super leftists in the bluegrass scene and a lot of right wingers too. And, things got pretty real in like the Trump years and then going into like COVID. Oh my God. Like, you know, pretty soon it's like not just fun and games to like go to the bluegrass jam and rub elbows with everybody. Cause like, who knows whether they're vaccinated or giving a single shit about it. So it's right. like a little more life and death. And like people might think I'm being hyperbolic, but I'm literally not. Like the station in's owner, JT, died of COVID. As an old man, because right. they did not care about it. They refused to have a masking or vax policy for the venue. And it literally fucking killed him. So that, that is like very real. Like it got real in the bluegrass yeah. scene. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And now, you know, his kids took over the station and there's even more right wing, you know, like I think they were just trying to be like kind of live and let live, you know, and the station was pretty damn cool. But his kids are even more kind of right wing. And the person that is booking it now is, you know, I think might be a registered sex offender.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting thing. You can find out his name. You can search the internet. You can find the articles that everybody knows are there.
That sounds problematic. I want to jump in for 1 second to say to anyone who doesn't know about the station in Nashville, it's basically where the studio musicians go to play the music that they actually care about. And some on tour
bluegrass
bands.
Specifically bluegrass music.
The bluegrass musicians, it's like kind of a, I remember going there as a kid and eating popcorn and seeing like Aubrey Haney play it. It was magical. And that is wild. I didn't know any of that stuff. So anyway,
big
history. Continue.
It is big history, and it is a special place. And I will still go there from time to time, even though I really don't vibe with the current management. Let's put it that way.
Sure.
And I would love to, we really want to bring our Grateful Drag band, Bertha.
We would
love to play at the Station Inn and do Bertha in the Way. but I know for a fact that they would pretty much their heads would explode if there was drag at the Station Inn. They've actually said as much. So, culture wars and bluegrass, fun times. Anyway, so bluegrass shit posting, you know, I was on there like causing a stir. Our band would, you know, what I was always outspoken on stage, you know, for progressive stuff. That really came from, we did our first UK tour in like 2016, I think, like just before the election. And we had people in the UK asking us if we were like Trump fans. And this is a podcast. You can't see me on the Zoom. Like if there's clips, you'll see me. I have like glasses and pink hair. The fact that they thought that, I just realized that like it was not obvious to anyone where we stood unless we said where we stood, you know, and especially as white folks. So that just made us much more outspoken, making sure that we were like, you know, planting a flag for progressive folks in bluegrass who were like out there touring, doing the thing. So it kind of sort of started there. And then, you know, coming out of 2020, I was looking for what would kind of restore the joy in music for me. And me and my friend Caitlin were talking about doing a all-female Grateful Dead cover band. And then we sort of realized that all the badass female musicians we knew in town, like, didn't like the Grateful Dead at all. Like, we didn't know anyone who was, like, a big Deadhead. And me and her were like peripheral Deadheads. Like we came up on some of that music, you know, it was very like nostalgic for us. And we like love the whole lore of it. And we've always thought that it was like super campy secretly. You know, if you look at the lyrics of those songs, these characters, you know, like Cosmic Charlie and like Ramble on Rose, you know, they're like these old timey, ridiculously campy, like they could all be drag names. When we were talking about this, we were also like, well, I was like, well, my partner Jacob would be very sad if he couldn't be in this band. He's a huge Deadhead. And then our friend Thomas, Brian Eaton, would be so sad if he couldn't be in the band. He's an incredible, incredible guitar player and Deadhead, huge nerd. So we knew some people who would love to be in it. And we're like, well, we could just put him in drag. And then it's still an all-girl band. And then we're like, wait. And we just started like giggling uncontrollably about this idea. And then I was like, oh, the band will be called Bertha and everyone's name will be Bertha. and so everybody's drag name is Bertha. And it also allows us to have like a rotating cast of people and also like secret special guests who are just like, it's Bertha. Like you don't even know who it is because they're in full makeup and drag. And like Kyle Tuttle played at the first show and people did not recognize him at all. He was so fishy. It was great.
Wow.
That's this project was spawned. We were actually talking about that like the last year. We're still in 2023 here, the very end of it when we're recording this.
That's
I don't know. Should I say that? Should I not say that?
Anyway, that's
okay. We can put it this way. In 2022 is when we had this idea in like the summer and we started talking about it. And then in early 2023, Tennessee tried to pass a ban on drag shows and any kind of drag in public, any kind of drag anywhere that was like all ages. And they were really trying hard to ban it and make it like an adult entertainment thing where you'd have to have like specific cabaret license to do it. Right. And like just really messing with people's bag, you know?
Yeah.
Like already marginalized people's bag.
Totally.
And then they also, you know, arguably even worse, passed a ban on transgender youth healthcare. which was really scary. I know a lot of trans people who moved out of state when that happened, because things were just getting real. So when that stuff came down in the legislation, in January, February, we were like, oh my God, should we do this stupid idea? It was just like this idea that we had sort of like floated and laughed about with some friends. I feel like those are the best ideas. If you have like really stupid ideas that you've just been like floating out there and chuckling about with your friends, you're like, wouldn't it be crazy if we did this? You should do it.
Yeah, do it.
It turned out to be like the most joyful, stupid, fun thing ever. We also raised like over $4,000 for, you know, local LGBTQ causes and Trans Aid Nashville. And it was so great. And that was just at D's Country Cocktail Lounge. If anyone's been there, it's like a tiny dive bar. But, you know, we were putting it together with like 2 months notice, and we didn't know how it was going to go. We needed to be kind of low pressure. And D's is like the low pressure place where we all hang out, and like, you know, there's bluegrass and Americana stuff there. So we did it at D's. And they have a live stream that they always do on their YouTube, which is great. You can always catch like really good stuff on their YouTube channel, actually, like people workshopping their new projects and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, keep an eye out. Like, all kinds of people are always coming through there. So we had the live stream too, and we had like thousands of people watching from around the country, because
yes,
it kind of went viral in the deadhead scene, like the cool side of the deadhead scene.
Right.
There's a not very much not cool side of the deadhead scene that really had a problem. I was actually surprised by the level of hate that there was, because you really would think that that's a pretty loving, chill scene, but yeah, not so much, not as much as you would think. And so that's like my villain era, is like trying to expose, you know, people in your midst who you may not know are bigots, you know, like once you sort of call their bluff, they start to show themselves.
Make them feel uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. So that's what we're doing. And so Bertha got written up in Rolling Stone and San Francisco Chronicle in print in the date book, and Yahoo Entertainment. Turns out the lady who's the head of Yahoo Entertainment is a queer deadhead herself.
Whoa.
And so she was like, I want to write about this. It's like, they're everywhere. We're everywhere, as they say. And yeah, so it went kind of viral. Also, TJ Osborne showed up at the show. One of the brothers Osborne, who he's like the first out gay male country star, like major label country star. Like, they're huge. And I talked to him after the show. We like went up and shot the shit with him, and I was like, are you a deadhead, dude? And he reaches into his bling. He had like a bunch of chains on, and he pulls out all his chains out of his t-shirt, and he had like this beautiful steely chain.
Wow.
Nice. I was like, all right, man. So it's just, you never know. I feel like the deadhead closet is like the other closet. There's like, you never know who's like a secret deadhead. And among musicians too, there's kind of a stigma a little bit, right? Because they're such a train wreck as a live band, like, and we're so focused on execution all the time,
right?
And so like, it's like, it has this bad rap. The dead have this bad rap for being like kind of hack musicians or something, but it's not true. Like, they're incredible, but they just were taking so many risks and so many drugs that know, it might be a wild card a little bit. But I have come to appreciate, especially in this era of like healing, post like being on the road for 10 years solid with a band that was like really grinding it out, I have really come to appreciate vibes over execution. And the Grateful Dead are completely like, they have always been so clear about that. They've always been so impeccable about it being about vibes and like taking risks and like reaching and trying to push the envelope and doing something different every time. And that is so inspiring.
Totally.
For me, as someone who was just like, execution's everything, right? Right? If I just execute it every night, it's doing the thing. And it's like, I was lost in the sauce, girl. Like, it's not even, not even close. So the Grateful Dead has been like healing me from that, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I also really love the songs too.
Well, they're really, and I never appreciated them until I moved to Colorado. And then you're not a Colorado fiddle player with gigs if you can't play Grateful Dead songs, and they're also really hard to guess, so you really have to learn them in order to perform them. So in terms of being a supervillain, though, you were kind of vilified by some people too. You know, all that exposure kind of got you some hate mail, did it not? Or is that more that song Jesus Was a Drag Queen that did that?
Oh yeah, so I went on this weird TikTok journey in 2022 and 2023. Early 22, I got on TikTok and I just started talking about being a songwriter tips, music industry stuff, and people started asking me questions, and I just kept talking on there, and I ended up building quite a following. And my TikTok is banned now.
Good job.
It got taken down. I don't think that it had to do with things that I was saying. It's hard to tell. It could have been malicious, but I don't think it was. I think it was like copyright poaching, possibly even botted out of Dubai.
Oh, wow.
Like two different random companies that the only info I can find is that they're out of Dubai, flagged my stuff, like flagged three videos, like two of which were just talking videos, my face talking into the camera. Like, and they were like, those are ours. And TikTok was like, cool, we believe you, even though we have all the metadata to prove that she recorded that into this app on her platform. So yeah, TikTok took my account down. It could have also been, I've heard from a couple people that it could have been, I joined the creator program beta, and so I was making a little bit of money off of it finally, which I had not been for like 2 years. I've been doing a lot of like work on it without being paid, and it was paying off a little bit. And a friend of mine who's in tech said that probably it was a mix of, like, you know, totally bogus copyright strikes that they sustained, and then when I appealed them, they're like, they look at my account and they're like, well, she was making too much money off of us. You know what I mean? They probably thought she was making too much money anyway, so we might as well shut this account down, maybe. It's not like I was making like a lot of money, but they were probably like, well, why would we restart this if it means that we have to like pay her to make content or something? So this is, let's see, what was I talking about? Oh yeah, so I was on TikTok. I had a lot of hot takes. You know, I had some bluegrass dunkings happened. I had a few songs go like semi-viral on there. One was called Jesus Was a Drag Queen, that was also written about this legislation, trying to call in the Bible Belt to some of their better inclinations. It starts out as kind of a troll, but the song is really quite an earnest song about, like, you know, a progressive side of Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not much of, you know, I'm not a believer in the Christian sense of Jesus. But, you know, I think what he is said to have said is pretty groovy stuff, mostly. And I can get down with it. I'm into, like, hippie, like, 70s musical Jesus.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, Godspell, Jesus Christ Superstar.
Sure.
Groovy Jesus. Yeah, let's get into it. Hippie Jesus. So, yeah, me and my friend Mercy Bell wrote that, and that kind of went viral, and so we released it. We released a couple versions of it. And then I had a song that I wrote with Phoebe Hunt and Bonnie Sims, go pretty mega viral, that we recorded at Planet Bluegrass in the silo there.
Yeah.
And so we're calling ourselves the Silo Sisters.
Oh, I didn't know why that name was. Cool. Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause the video, we recorded the video by candlelight in the silo, and it was friggin' magical. And the reverb is beautiful in there. Yeah. And it was a song that was like, it was a pretty deep song about trauma, and a lot of people were resonating with it. Like, the comment section on those couple different versions of it on TikTok and on Instagram are pretty heavy to read, honestly. Like, people shared all kinds of stuff in there, and it just went super viral. People were asking us to release the TikTok audio like Spotify, so they could just stream it. And we had no way, like, we were all kind of like touring and various, you know, doing various things. And we had no way to like get together and record it really fast. And so we're like, well, shoot, maybe we should just release the TikTok audio and let it do what it's going to do. And so My apologies to all the audiophiles in the audience right now. But that's what we did. We released iPhone video audio outdoor, like in the silo with this, with us like sitting on these like creaky folding chairs. Like just that audio from the video on Spotify. You know, it says like TikTok original audio. And that we got like over 1,000 pre-saves for it, pushing it on TikTok for like a few days. And which is like, I haven't gotten that for any of my releases this year for my own stuff. And it got like instantly like 40,000 streams in the first couple days.
Wow.
That it was out. And like none of my stuff has done that well this year. I'm releasing my own like solo music again after Front Country, and none of it has done that well.
Yeah.
So that's really exciting. And I'm grateful for the opportunity, even though it's like a fickle beast, you know? So those were probably the two biggest songs. And I do think TikTok is a really powerful tool for music.
Well, you got some hate mail for it. Didn't you not? You got fans, but you also got some haters.
Yeah. Got some haters.
That's the super villain part.
Got one kind of creepy threat on TikTok too. And I caught wind of a few things. I caught wind of like people sharing our stuff on like Telegram channels for right wing gun toting types of groups. Right. That's great. We love that. So, you know, it's a little sketchy. Tennessee is a little sketchy. I'm from the San Francisco Bay Area, so sometimes I forget that I live in Tennessee now. But I think it's worth it. That song, Jesus Was a Drag Queen, we actually had a lot of feedback from progressive churches and pastors who are part of affirming congregations who wanted to use it at their own church. So that's pretty friggin' cool.
Yeah.
I'm really, really honored by that. We made like a little lead sheet for it, made like a lyric sheet, made a lyrics and chords sheet, and sheet music. And
nice.
Yeah, we had that available for download on my website and stuff, and people were getting it.
Yeah. I think in a culture where there is more open hate now, just kind of being openly spread and shared and stuff, it's more and more brave to just be who you are, and to also to be the drag queen thing is like, it's wild. And as I'm personally a very long time fan of drag shows. My first one was in Key West, and my whole family went, and my grandma came, and she was like,
"Aww, I love drag queens.
It's this Key West."
Yay. And
so, yeah, but I never thought it would be me. So here's my personal drag story is that my wife, Joy Adams, plays the cello, and she was part of a super group that was going to play this festival. And they needed a thrown together female band because they hadn't booked enough women. So they showed up and they were like, "Oh, why do you have all these penis toys?" And they're like, "Oh, 'cause we're the spirit dicks of the Rocky Mountains." And this festival wouldn't let in any partners of the band with a free ticket. And I really wanted to go to hang out. And the only way that I could go to the festival for free was to be in the band. And the only way I could be in the band that I could figure out was to play a song in drag. And so I did.
And so now they do that more often now, right? They have dudes sit in.
So I set the tone, and then they became a Big Richard for their second show. And here they are now touring everywhere. And quite successful, lots of good things coming. And anytime you see a man on stage with that band, they're going to be in drag, and it's my fault.
I love it so much. I love it so much. I didn't realize that was from the inception of the band, like the very first gig. That is friggin' wild. So yeah, it's spreading around, this whole drag band thing. I think it's a revolution. I think. Also, that have you seen hair metal? Like, it's not the first time. Have you seen David Bowie? Like, have you seen like literally any performer of music from all time? Like, everybody's flamboyant. It's always gender bendy. It's always been that way. And we're just having a moral panic right now, honestly. And we really need to spoof that. Because, like, how many of these boomers that are upset about drag, like, were so into, like, all the hair metal bands when they were, you know, when they were, like,
maybe
20
maybe
years
old.
Maybe
they forgot about fun. I don't know. It's like...
I think they did. I think they really did. They've lost their damn minds. But we're trying to bring fun back into the Grateful Dead too with Bertha, because like there is like there's this thing with Grateful Dead cover bands that they can just be so snooze town.
Have to be literal,
boring. Like, like they just stand there though. There's like a thing with jam bands that I just hate, which is like stand and deliver, and like never learn how to sing worth a good goddamn, and like. I can't stand that. Like the voice is an instrument. It's worthy of also being good at, being virtuosic at. And like, they don't see that. They just want like guitar wanking only. And as long as you can wank the guitar, like it's actually better if you can't sing that good. Like that's how they feel about it. But I swear to God.
The spirit of that music is all about creativity and spontaneity. So the idea that you're being a cover band by preserving a specific experience is so bizarre, when I think really more in the spirit of it is to do something new and sing those songs.
Yes. Do something new with it. Yeah. So we wanted to like reframe it. And I think we're really freshening up the Dead cover band experience in a lot of ways, actually. Like part of it is that we have two female lead singers. That are like cis women who are also in drag. And so we do end up changing some keys on songs, although Jerry's quite a high singer a lot of the time. Usually it's in a good key for me, but some of them are low and some of them have to change keys. And for some reason, you know, the fans are like, what was different about that version? It's like, cause it was like up like a third, you know? Or like, you know, we'll play with tempos a little bit, you know, and like keep it energetic. And a lot of those Dead bands can be so sloggy, including Dead bands with original members in them, even, you know.
Yeah, totally. Well, we've gone the farthest I've ever gone in an episode without explicitly stating the River of Suck analogy. So I'm going to diverge for one moment so we can take a trip down the river.
Okay, do it.
So... The River of Suck is an imaginary river that runs through your mind. And here you are on your comfort shore. Behind you is your comfort cave. That's where we do all the things we already know how to do. Stuff that's comfort zone, stuff that's easy. No worries. And we see in the far distance on the other side of the River of Suck, little teeny versions, future versions of ourselves who can do the things that we wish we could do now. However, in between us and future us is the raging River of Suck, filled with whitewater rapids, rocks, and thought piranhas. Those thoughts that kind of just enter your mind and sabotage your good vibes. I'm not good enough. My song's not good enough. What will they think of me? But the point being, in order to reach that other side of your goals, you have to swim through the River of Suck. There's no bridge, and you have to get bit by the thought piranhas, get slammed against the rocks, and still come out on the other side. You have to suck at something before you can be good at it. So that's the River of Suck. So I'm curious, Melody, where do you see that in your music or your life, and what kind of thought piranhas do you have? Does this make sense?
It does make sense, and I've listened to your podcast before, so I've heard this metaphor. I have something to add to it, potentially.
Yeah, please.
And I want to run this by you, because when you were talking about it, I was like, thought piranhas, could the rocks be cringe rocks?
Oh my God.
Rocks of cringe, because when you're on, even when you get to that distant shore, you're going to look back and see those rocks in the river, and you're gonna be like, "Youch, cringe. Like, that was cringe. Like, was I remember me. That rock.
Oh, no.
Like, that was me.
Yeah.
Like, I remember running into that rock. Like, and sometimes you can avoid some of the cringe rocks, but, like, you know, you can't make an omelet without breaking a few cringe eggs, you know, just to mix metaphors here.
Yeah.
That's something I think people are so afraid to be cringe. And cringing is part of it. If you're not cringing, you're not trying. You're not swimming the river of suck.
Yeah.
And it's going to be part of it. Like, being cool is not part of it. Like, you're not going to look cool when you're like swimming for your life in rapids, you know?
Yeah. Like,
and that's also not the point. The point is to get through it and to get where you're going. It's a process. Not like, we're so used to being perceived. And I think especially women are really used to being perceived all the time. And we can be so afraid of, like, at every moment being like, oh my God, do I look good while I'm drowning right now in the river of suck? And it's like, girl, like, keep swimming. Like, it's not about that. But, like, it's really hard to not see it about that, especially when we have social media. You're, like, posting every day while you're in the river of suck. And you're like, oh, having so fun. So having so much fun. Not drowning right now. Ah, you know, like.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So that makes it really hard, I think. And I think that the self-consciousness, that's not going to help you when you're trying to get through a river of suck, right? Like, it need not apply. And you got to, like, that's the thought piranhas, I think, you know, or the, like, self-consciousness. What if somebody sees me sucking right now? What if I'm, like, smashed against a cringe rock? And, like, that's just how it goes. I think that you can do just suck streams too. You know, you can take it in little bits. You don't have to dive into like some massive rapids that are like, especially if you're not in a place where you feel strong enough to, right? Like you can do little suck streams, you know, if it's just one little thing that gets out of your comfort zone, making yourself like get on stage after not being on stage for like the whole pandemic and getting back on stage.
Totally.
One time to like sit in with the band or something, or like do one song in a variety thing. And tolerance is a thing, you know, and like small wins are really important.
Yeah.
Especially, I mean, we all thrive on dopamine, right? So like having little hits of dopamine that you can get, like little milestones. Like, I don't know, maybe the stones are actually helpful and they're like something you can like rest against for a moment. Like your small wins. Like maybe they're not cringe stones. Maybe cringe is another, maybe they're cringe rapids. Well, I don't know.
Well, no, I was just thinking the same thing. Like maybe you're swimming across the river and then one of these cringe rocks is like high enough that you can actually get out of the water and like catch your breath for a moment. And when you're later on the other side, you check back and you're like, oh man. I can't believe that happened like that. But in the moment, you're still progressing.
Yeah.
And you're taking a breath. And maybe that's important. Somehow.
Totally. Yeah. Maybe the cringe can be part of it. Maybe like if I really want to like make that metaphor work, like maybe we do cringe, and especially in retrospect, because we look at moments where we felt like we were a little comfortable.
Yeah.
Like we're like, oh yeah, I thought I had it figured out in that moment when I made that album, that snapshot, you know, like I did that one video and I was like, oh yeah, I felt like, oh yeah, I'd kind of made it to a shore of some kind. And it's like, girl, that wasn't the shore. That was just a rock in the middle of the river. And like, in looking back, you're cringing because now you're on the other side and you're so much better, you know? But those things, those small wins and those small respites, you know, for your ego are like a little helpful when you are making such a journey.
Yeah.
I don't know. The question too is there another side? You know, it's like, is there ever a destination? And I do think like it's a little problematic to always have this idea of like there's this bigger, better deal. There's this place you're going to get to, because I think that is somewhat the like capitalist lie, is like if you just struggle enough in these rapids, you're going to get somewhere where it's easy and everything's great again, you know? And it's like maybe that's not necessarily true. And I feel like that's also, you know, the lie of a lot of the monotheistic religions too, you know, is like, oh, there's going to be this thing later where it's going to all have been worth it.
You'll once you get to heaven, then all your sacrifices in life will be,
Right. When arguably, you know, those religions were also, you know, codified to prop up capitalism and people exploiting their own labor.
Yeah. I don't think it has to be such a big scope, though, because the river of suck could just be like finishing a song. And like you were saying, you write 10 songs and on the 10th song, it's better. But what if people are just so afraid of sucking and being judged that they can't start one thing? And then that huge chasm of the river is just it's super vast, even though the goal is like totally attainable, you know?
Maybe it's like not that helpful for them to know it, but just knowing that there's like another river after that and another river after that and another river after that. And then it does get easier. Yeah. I feel like the rivers get smaller, right? Like it's like maybe that's more what it is that like the first one is going to be like the hardest to get through. And like, because you don't know how long it's going to take. You don't know the process. You don't know yourself. Yeah. Like, and then every time it gets a little bit easier, like each like stream crossing until you're like just crossing this little trickle, you know?
Do you like cold plunges by any chance?
I don't really fuck okay. that. No, but I have some friends who do.
Okay. Well, I do like cold plunges, but those first moments of getting in are terrifying and the hardest part. And so I think once you're like in it, you can kind of swim around and it's okay. But when you first touch it and you realize just how scary it is and how cold it is, that can send you just running away from that. And when it comes to like accomplishing something that you legitimately like to do in your life.
I mean, maybe people should ask themselves, would you rather just finish this fucking song or plunge yourself into icy cold water in Colorado in the winter outside of your house? You choose. Like, there are harder things in life than finishing a fucking song. Like, just like do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like you got to take your time, though, and you got to mean it. And sometimes when you're like using your intuition and you're trying to like finish a song, it's going to be like, no, I don't have the answer yet for this. Like, you're going to need to wait a week or a month or a year or several years until you have this life experience to finish this one particular song. And you also, they don't have to be one at a time. You can like start many songs. Like, I have so many songs. Like, I probably have 20 songs in progress right now and a bunch of other like kind of orphan nuggets around. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like, it's a whole thing, you know, have some kind of organization for yourself to be able to keep track of it. Don't be throwing away your stuff. Don't be thinking, oh, I'm going to remember that idea later. 'Cause you won't. So just write it down. Like, I feel like that's a big part of the process of being a songwriter is like making sure that you're just showing up for your artistic self, you know, and you're like, you're willing to like honor that muse. If you want to put it outside yourself and make it the muse, make it spiritual, make it, you know, God talking to you, whatever works for you. Like the universe speaking to you, channeling through you. It's like, if you reject that on a regular basis, it's not going to keep coming to you. Like, you're trying to have your antenna tuned to that. And so you have to like respect that and be, you know, getting down a little voice memo or a note or whatever it takes to like capture whatever idea came to you. Like, voice memos are the best because I like to try to sing something into my phone, you know, and then you go back and listen to it and like half the time it surprises you and you're like, where the hell did that come from?
Right.
And that's a great question. Where the hell does it come from?
That actually is my next question.
Like, great.
And you started too by talking about co-writing and egos. And I think that coincides right there with thought piranhas and just the negative self-talk. When those ideas first show up, a lot of people's first reaction is to judge them. And like, how do we get these ideas out so they can exist long enough for us to judge them in an editing process, maybe, or like to share them with a co-writer? You know, how do you swim past this thing that's biting your leg off?
you do need to like fight off the piranhas. They're not piranhas. I think transforming them into like clouds in the sky,
whoa,
to use like a mindfulness Zen meditation metaphor,
cool,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, to see them more, they become piranhas when you see them as like these things that are able to interrupt you and you give them that power. But I think that if you can see them more as, you know, clouds going through the sky, intrusive thoughts that you can be like, I notice you. Okay, cool. Good point. And like, be on your way if you, you know, go in peace.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the way to look at, you know, anything like that. Intrusive, not helpful thoughts during the creative process. You don't want to like repress them, because that won't work. That actually gives them more power. You just have to be like, okay, I notice you, and so what? I'm going to keep writing this. And you just kind of like treat it like a little annoying, like my cat bothering me for food when he's already been fed or something like that.
Yeah, it's fear personified. That's, or I guess fish aren't people, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Wow.
But you also just have to, I think something that you can tell those mm-hmm. things, and I've heard a lot of writers talk about this, is you can be like, okay, later. And you just have that boundary with them. You're like, okay, like not right now though. How about later? Like, because later is the time for editing
yeah.
and that critical thinking to come in and that capacity. But when you're in kind of the creative space, I do, for me at least, and I've heard for a lot of other writers, it really helps them to have like this hard delineation between your kind of creative flow state yeah. side and the editing, more cerebral kind of critical side.
Right.
So yeah, I sometimes like I call that like flow and craft sometimes.
Totally.
Like I'll teach a workshop sometimes that's like the DAO of songwriting, essentially, like as culturally appropriative as that is, you know, it's kind of like a yin and yang situation. There's a dichotomy of like when you're in like the flow state
yeah.
versus the craft state and having both sides of that. And like the cool thing about it is that usually we're stronger in one side or the other naturally. Some people are so great at they could just like spit bars and like stream of consciousness and they have that flow, but their editor needs a little work and like the craft of the writing needs a little work. And then for some people, the craft side comes really easily and like all those like language art skills and, you know, knowing your like similes and metaphors and alliteration and, you know, having structure and editing comes really easily and the flow state is harder to access for them. So getting clear about which part is easier for you is the first step.
Yeah.
And then trying to strengthen your skills in the side that you feel a little deficient in. Is a good idea, you know?
Yeah.
And it, what's nice is like the concrete side of like craft, that's to me, that's the easier side to improve on.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's just very concrete. You can read books about it, you know,
right.
Like the flow state and accessing like ideas and stream of consciousness. That takes a little more like spiritual mindfulness practice to do. Like maybe you do morning pages, like from the artist's way.
Yeah.
And you sit there and you just write and write and write on a piece of paper and spew it all out. You know, maybe you do a practice of every day you're going to just put your voice memos on and start improvising on your instrument or your voice, or maybe both totally. Together. Something that is getting you in a flow state. Sometimes you need to be like moving to do it. Maybe when you're going on a walk or on a drive, like I always get ideas when I'm driving.
Yeah, that's me. Yeah.
But I would never pick up my phone and record a voice memo. I would never. That couldn't be me. Anyway, if I die in a car crash, you'll know what was happening. But I did it for art.
I'm guilty for some reason. Like I forget if I'm coming up with new lyrics, I forget them instantly. So I have to write them down. And visually seeing them helps me come up with what's next. So, you know, I'm certainly would never have on a lonesome Montana highway have written lyrics down into a notebook while driving. I would have never done that.
That's for sure not. That's even sketchier for sure. Well, someday we'll have driverless cars and we'll just be sitting in the back writing.
Oh yeah. The ultimate
playing our instruments, practicing, rehearsing. It'll be
traveling.
Great. Yeah. Yeah, man, there's just so many different ways. There's a lot of great books on both the flow side and the craft side of songwriting. But just figure out which one you feel is more kind of your home base and then which side you need to develop more skills in and try to balance it out because it takes both sides to tango.
I'm curious to, since you do so much co-writing, how you manage to keep things really positive. You know, obviously you can't use every idea from everybody in a song, and I'm actually working on a book right now and I have a co-writer. We're always working together and we're like changing each other's sentences sometimes. Like we'll write a sentence and then the other person kind of, you know, we'll just delete whole chunks and no one takes it personally, but it does seem to me like part of it is maybe just being comfortable with someone enough to know that the editing is coming from a good place and not like your ideas are bad. it's like we're working towards a common goal that's bigger than like whose ideas are the best. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think like avoiding destructive deleting is good, or destructive editing. Mm-hmm. Like, so I see a lot of people have a practice of like, I'll co-write a lot on Google Docs. Yeah. So the AI is learning how all of us Nashville songwriters are writing our songs, and they're going to put us out of business, I'm sure. But do a lot of writing on Google Docs, especially, you know, post COVID, because people were doing Zoom writes, and then you're on the same page on a Google Doc. It's like so easy. But a lot of times people will just sort of like copy paste something down on like the next page of the document, you know, and keep ideas down there that aren't being used, you know, and then kind of have the song that's being built at the top of the doc.
Yeah. Yeah. We're doing that too. Yeah. It's like, I don't want to delete this idea, but we're going to move it down here.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I mean, you got to talk it out. It's so hard. That's such a hard question of like, when do you fight for your ideas and when do you think the other person is right? You know? And that's something that just takes practice, doing co-writing, sort of getting that perspective too, of like times when you fought for an idea and you were wrong, or times when you thought you should have fought for an idea after the co-write. Yeah. And then you go back and you're like, oh, they were totally right. Like, I'm so glad I didn't fight for that idea because they had it right. So just getting that perspective and that experience is key, because it is so subjective and it's so like scary and blurry, like, but the things that I find that are tools, that I've learned by co-writing with friends here in Nashville, which I pretty much just write with my friends.
Awesome.
Like the things that I've learned, it's very yes and based, you know, like right. Improv.
Yep.
It's very much, you want to veer toward yes. Mm-hmm. And then adding to the thing, being constructive, not destructive. You know, there is a time for destructive editing. But trying to just be constructive as much as you can, being yes and moving it forward.
Mm.
And those are the most delightful co-writes because, you know, the song writes itself in an hour, you know?
Yeah.
Instead of like trying to edit as you go and beating your head against a wall, second guessing every idea, you can just always know that you can do kind of that first write down and get, sometimes it's placeholder lyrics, for certain things, but just getting the whole form there and seeing kind of what you have and then going back and editing is a great way to go. I find it harder to write with people who want to edit as they go, but there is a place for trying a little bit in a moment to get the right thing in that spot.
Yeah.
But two things I think really help move the process forward and keep people's egos from getting like bruised about it.
Yeah.
And one of those things is being okay with like placeholder. If you like try figuring out a line for a while and you find that you're spending too much time on it, you know, and you have something that's like close, you know, and you're like almost there, but you just can't find it. You can be like, okay, let's put a pin in this placeholder for now.
Come back later.
And we can, that allows us to move on. Like we know that this isn't the final thing that we want. And then we move on. So being able to do that is great because you have to keep moving forward in some ways. And the other thing is this phrase that I learned here in Nashville, which I just love. And that's instead of saying like, I don't like that idea, I think it sucks, to your co-writer, you just say, I think we can beat it.
Yes.
Isn't that good? It's so good. And it's like, it, even though I know it's kind of a trick, I like to hear that more than I hate your idea, it sucks, you know, or like, that's not the best idea I've ever heard. I would rather hear, I think we can beat it, because it's giving credit to the people in the room. You're like, I think we're even smarter than this. I think we're even better than this. We're better writers than this and we can do better. And I believe in us, you know, like, and that sounds so condescending to say, but just, I think we can beat it is a nice way to say, not that idea. Let's try the next idea. Or
maybe moving it acknowledges too that it's the right direction, but we're not there yet. So like, let's keep working on it.
Exactly.
Yeah, I love that.
Exactly. Exactly. It's like constructive and positive. That is really key. And like enthusiasm is how co-writes run. That's like the fuel of co-writes is enthusiasm. And that's why I love co-writing, because writing by yourself can be pretty lonely and torturous sometimes. Yeah. You know, but having someone else there to distract you or be like, even be like, hey, let's take a snack break or whatever it is. Like having another person in the room who's like, yeah, it's great. And like the thing when you're writing alone that's so torturous is like, is this the right idea? I don't know. Oh my God. What if, like, is it the right idea? And then if you have someone else in the room who half the time is like, yeah, that's it. It's like, I love that. Or like, no, that's not it. Like, it's just, it's very decisive to have like a second opinion right there in the room with you. And, you know, it's just one person's second opinion, but it's a lot better than just being alone and being like stuck on like, I don't know if this is the right line, you know, or the right direction or a good idea even.
Yeah. Writing with my friend Max on this book, we're finishing each other's sentences, but we're also, you know, typing into the Google Doc at the same time. And we'll just write bad jokes to each other and that we know we're never going to make it out into the final product. But we're always just throwing stuff out there. And sometimes it lands and we're like, they're like, haha, that's a good joke. And you're like, no, actually, it's brilliant and it's staying.
No, yeah. Like there's sometimes with co-writing, actually a lot of the time, there will be lines that will be like, haha, just kidding, unless...
Yeah.
You know, like it's like, and sometimes those lines where it's like a little bit of an inside joke or an Easter egg or something, or like sometimes you're like, no, wait, that's perfect. And the other person like loves
it. And it's always like you have a little doubt about it, but you still are drawn to like put it on the paper for a second just to see it. Then it's good.
Yeah. And the more that you have ideas like that and you do put them out there and you take the chance and someone else is like, yes, oh my God, that's the best thing I've ever heard. Then you're like, oh, wow, my self-doubt is not worth much, honestly. Those thought piranhas are kind of bullshit, honestly. Like, they're not about whether the idea is good at all. It's just your insecurities. And like, it's just one opinion.
Yeah.
It's like, well, that's like your opinion, bro. You know, like, that's all.
Because they're going to tell you that your idea sucks, whether it does or doesn't. That's the problem. They only have one opinion. Your music sucks.
Yeah. And then something else that I find like helpful just in life in general, like I've never been much of an affirmations person. Like you can try with those, but they actually are like, you know, proven to also hurt you. Because they're very like shaming.
Okay.
You know, there's a lot of shame involved with them. Like, because if it doesn't work, you're like kind of stuck.
Oh yeah.
But something that actually is like, proven more in like the science is affirmations. And I love affirmations.
I don't know about affirmations.
Do you know about affirmations?
Tell us about affirmations.
So affirmations are, instead of saying like, I am a great songwriter. I'm like looking in the mirror. I'm good enough. I'm smart enough. And doggone it, people like me, right? Like, I'm so old. Oh my God. anyway, that's some 90s SNL in case anyone realized the reference. Okay. So it's like looking in the mirror and being like, I am a great songwriter. And affirmations are like, what if this was a great song? What if you were a really great songwriter? Like, what if you could be the best songwriter ever if you just put the work in? Like, so it's like, what ifs? And it's like introducing doubt to the thought piranhas. You know, the thought piranhas are like so sure of themselves, you know? And you're like, well, what if you're wrong though? Like, because the thing about affirmations is that your brain can't disprove it.
Yeah.
It can't disprove an if statement. And so it's kind of like, you know, if you're catastrophizing in your brain, it could be really helpful to be like, what if everything just turns out okay though? What if it's going to be okay? And your brain can't disprove it. Instead of your brain being like, stop gaslighting me, you bitch. Like, because that's a horrible thing to do to yourself. Like, why would you gaslight yourself if things are crappy right now and you legitimately have a feeling in your body that is like feeling crappy? I don't think that it personally, that it helps to gaslight yourself. I think that that's actually really destructive. And I'm not a big fan of affirmations for that reason, but I think affirmations are really cool and they leave room for growth and you can't disprove it no matter how hard you try.
Yeah, you're like a thought piranha psychologist. I love it.
I mean, those thought piranhas, they are kind of part of the whole game that you got to get
over.
It's
just to stand in for fear. It's fear. That's all it is.
Yeah.
Fear wants to.
It's just fear.
Wants us to
yeah.
drop everything and pay attention to it. So it wants to be yes. acknowledged.
And it thinks it's the most important. Like, yeah, it thinks it's the biggest, baddest, most important. And it's not. It's just one among many different emotions and yeah. important feelings in our life. And like fear is important, by the way.
Yeah.
In important scenarios, you need fear. It helps you act. It helps you get out of bad situations, right? It helps you.
That's why yeah, I don't drive off the highway.
We love that. Yeah. Right. And to be like, to be able to like just condescend to fear a little bit and be like, you know what? You're helpful sometimes. Thank you so much for your help sometimes. But right now is not one of those times, is it? So fuck off and I'll see you later. Like, I'll see you later when I'm editing and you can be like, I'm afraid this song is going to suck if I don't edit it. Sure. Like, you can come back then. We'll
that's reassess. An appropriate time. Yeah.
Yeah. But like, yeah, I mean, that's easier said than done. But if you can treat it just a little bit like a ridiculous little like kid, you know, who's like,
yeah,
you know, is like, it's not this big, bad monster. It's just like this, like, it's this loud thing that is small.
It's like a really fuzzy, cute animal hiding in a big monster suit.
Something like that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so just being like, oh, you're having a lot of big feelings right now, right? Fear. but this is not a time when I need your help. So thank you and good night.
Yeah. Well, I have one more question for you. I'm a big collector of disaster stories. Do you have any good disaster stories you can share with our River of Suck swim team? That's you listening.
Disaster, like a disaster of like sucking.
It's when something went terribly wrong, and obviously you're still here doing the thing that you do, so it didn't derail you entirely, but it was like hard to overcome.
Terribly wrong and hard to overcome. I mean, there's been so many indignities, you know. I'm trying to think of like which thing to talk about. There's been so many like stupid disasters on the road and stuff. But the thing lately that I like to talk about is like, you know, when 2020 happened and the shutdown happened, we were suddenly like off the road, had like all this time, right? You always want like that downtime. You're always just like doing laundry at home and then going back out on the road when you're really grinding it out in a band. And so suddenly had all this time, right? And of course, like all this anxiety started flooding in, you know, like all the stuff, the dysregulation that I had been sort of pushing down on the road, you know, and just kind of keeping in motion, hoping it wouldn't catch up with me for like 10 yeah. years. It all caught up with me basically. And I was like, wow, my body feels horrible and my brain is attacking me and all of these things, right? And then I also was like, wow, I suddenly have like all this time off, you know, I should be writing.
Yeah.
I should be creating music and like I should, right? And like, of course, that like I have such a demand avoidant brain. And so like, I was not inspired at all. In fact, I, you know, eventually like I warded it off for like many months. But in like November of 2020, I like came down pretty bad with like probably the biggest depression I've had in my life, you know. And I usually don't struggle with that, but it was like, clearly there was some stuff that I had been running away from and it was all like coming home to wow. roost, you know? And it was just like a lot of dysregulation on the road. And yeah, sitting still, it all kind of caught up with me. So, I was not writing. I was like super uninspired actually. And like, didn't know what I was going to do. Front Country decided to take a hiatus. And I was very much having like an existential crisis of like, I don't know what I want to do. Do I still want to like play music? Am I still like a songwriter? Because I don't feel inspired at all.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think I've lost touch with the joy of music and that's really scary. And so that's like what I was dealing with. And just it, you know, there was some meta-analysis of it, but it was really like a deep knowing, a deep feeling of like having been abandoned by music. Whoa. And that was terrifying. And I was super sad because like, you know, you've invested your life purpose and your identity mm-hmm. into it too, you know? And I don't recommend that. I mean, it can be very fulfilling, but also like you got to hold lightly to anything like that, because if it disappears for some reason, you're kind of left with nothing. So that's kind of how I was feeling. But I really had to dig down and figure out what my own like personal medicine was going to be to get out of the situation. And so I started making myself paint, which I, you know, we discussed earlier. I have no business thinking that I should be good at that at all, because I've never studied painting in my life. But I got like acrylic paints and just started like painting. And yeah, just taking the pressure off of myself to be doing the art that I'm supposedly good at. And just kind of waiting for like almost having like a child's beginner's mind for creativity and art. And was doing all kinds of various crafts and painting and stuff, and just kind of like waiting and listening to my intuition, about, you know, when it was going to be, when I felt like creativity was like there to flow, you know? And I wasn't quite ready to come back to songwriting, like when this happened, but Molly Tuttle asked me to write with her for her next bluegrass record in early 2021.
Oh, yeah.
Like in the dead of winter 2021. And I couldn't say no to that because like my dream has always been to be a bona fide Nashville songwriter, right. You know, yeah. Like, right. And write for other people and with other people and help them bring their vision to life. And I had mostly been focusing on myself and my music and, you know, doing my own songs in my own band. And this was like an opportunity, an invitation to do that. And I'm so thankful to her for giving me that opportunity. And I didn't know what was going to happen. I was terrified still because I was like, I haven't been writing at all for all of 2020. I feel like music may have abandoned me and I have lost the plot and it's never coming back. And but I also was like, fake it till you make it. Yep. And I was like, okay, I'm going to hop on this co-write, you know, with Molly, like over Zoom. And just start trying to write some songs. And we, you know, we talked about all the real shit, talked about where I was at, talked about where she was at. And the first song that we wrote was Crooked Tree on the first co-write that we did after this. Like, and I had been in this like depressive episode. And yeah, it really kind of like turned things around, because like even I had no idea if she would record it or if she even liked it, but I really liked it. And I was like, okay, we still got it. Like, this is probably one of the best songs that I've ever written. Molly's an amazing writer and co-writer too. And I just loved what we came up with together. Yeah. And so, yeah, it was like this little glimmer, you know, this little spark in the darkness of like, you can get it back. Like, and I think writing for other people really helped. Because it wasn't for me. I didn't have to figure out what the hell I was doing. It wasn't really attached to my ego, my career, which I had no idea if I had a career at this point. You know what I mean? I was like very lost. But, you know, being able to do it for somebody else and just try to do my best with the writing skills that I had to sort of do something that would work for them. That was liberating in a way. You just have to like really listen deep to yourself and what you need and what your medicine is in that moment. Like, we have the ability to sort of heal ourselves, you know, not in every way. I'm not going full woo-woo with this. I'm not like, just meditate and you'll heal your broken leg. Like, that's not what I'm saying. But we do have some ability to heal ourselves and our minds, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not like that. I can't vaccinate myself. You know what I mean? It took a lot of like really being okay with like slowing down and going at my own pace and really deeply listening to what I need in every moment and knowing when it wasn't time to be creating and pushing past everything and just like pushing.
Play through the pain. You know,
our culture is very... Yeah, our culture is very masculine in that way. Very like, you know, push past the pain always, you know, no pain, no gain. And that you can do that for a while, but you're cruising for a bruising eventually, you know. And, you know, even in the case of like working out or something or doing weightlifting and pushing past the pain, it's like you're cruising for a bruise. Yeah. Eventually, like you're probably going to injure yourself if you have that mentality all the time and you're not listening deeply to your own body, your own mind, your own intuition about what you need. And if you're just shutting off, numbing out, shutting off your body and your mind and your needs and sublimating all of that to capitalism, like you are cruising for a bruising. Like this is my sermon. This is my testimony. Yeah, if you're out there listening right now and that sounds like you, like cut it out. Have some freaking boundaries. It's just capitalism. Like it's not, it's just like fear.
There's nothing
wrong
with you.
It wants to be this really loud voice and it's just one system that we're working within here and you don't have to buy into everything about it and it will kill you. It's meant to exploit and extract every ounce of your labor, your love, your soul. Like, don't do it, girl.
Wow. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with you, dear listener. You're just great. We love you.
You're beautiful and amazing, and you are a songwriter if you think you're a songwriter.
You're a writer if you think you're a writer.
Anyone can write a song. Yeah. You're a writer. If you have some inkling in you that you can do a thing, you've like always thought, hey, I think I might be able to do a thing and I think I could be good at that or I could enjoy that. Like, just start doing it. That's all there is to do is to start doing it. You're going to learn. It's going to kick your ass, but like do it anyway.
Yeah. Well, spoiler alert on that story, Crooked Tree became the album title and it's one of Molly Tuttle's most popular songs. So nicely done.
She plays it every
from
show.
The deepest, darkest part to now.
Yeah.
It's so much good. Yeah.
Yeah, dude. I'm very lucky. We ended up writing three more songs that ended up on that record and that album won her first Grammy. So it's really exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think we can play our listeners a song. What do you got?
Oh my God.
Oh, well, you don't even have to pick now.
I don't know yet. I don't even know what I want to pick, but I can send you a file. I've got new music out. Probably maybe would send you Their Loss, which is like my latest single.
Perfect.
That I wrote with my friend Sarah Potenza. We did a lot of co-writing also coming out of the pandemic when I was like, okay, I can't write for me, but I'll write with my friends and for their projects. And then what's funny is I ended up recording two of the songs that Sarah and I wrote together because I realized that like through writing with other people, I could also find my voice again and figure out what I wanted to do.
Here's the newest single from Melody Walker. Check it out. 3, 2, 1.
They didn't want to know ya. No, they never really could. So they said that it was over. So what? So good. Every day that goes by, it gets easier in time. Still you won't remember why. Even cry, just tell yourself it's their loss. Even if you don't believe it, yeah, their loss. A new beginning in each end, their loss. And if you think about what might happen, just remember it was their loss and yours. They'll tell you that you're too much, but the truth always was, they're not enough. Just tell yourself it's there. even if you don't believe it.
Where can our listeners go to find you, find your music?
Yeah, they can go to melodywalker.com. I don't update my website that much because I'm in a free-floating zone these days. But they can find me at a number of places on the gram. So my regular handle is Melody Write Songs. It's just a sentence, you know, it's true. Bona fide Nashville songwriter. Yeah. And then you can find Bertha at Grateful Drag.
Yeah.
And that's a fun time. You should definitely follow Bertha.
Oh, yeah.
And also I run a weekly writer's round in Nashville with kind of the East Nashville, Americana, bluegrass, rootsy scene. And that's called Writer's Kitchen. And if people want to find that on Instagram, it's at Writer's Kitchen Round. And I do that every single Tuesday night. And I think that they're going to start doing a live stream of it, too. So you might be able to watch it wherever you are. And if you come through Nashville, you should definitely come through on a Tuesday. Sick. And check it out. And if you're a songwriter who doesn't suck, you should come play it.
Anything we should watch out for in 2024? Keep our eyes peeled?
Yeah, I got at least one more single coming out in early 2024 here. You know, we're focusing on growing Bertha. So if anybody wants to come out to Nashville and see Bertha, the Grateful Drag band, the one and only Grateful Drag band in the whole world.
That's right.
You can come see us on February 22nd at the Basement East. And we'll be doing some other stuff too. We're playing a couple festivals. Hopefully we'll book a couple more festivals. And we really definitely want to get out to Denver, the Bay Area, New York City, Chicago. We kind of want to hit those big markets. People are like clamoring for it already. They're like, when are you coming to my big city? So
you're going to crush Colorado.
I really want to do
out here,
it.
We are ready.
We've got some, obviously we have some good connects and stuff. I would love to see us play Meow Wolf just because I think it would be such a like redonkulous type of venue, but I have no idea what the deals are like there and stuff. And like, we'll see where we end up. There's so many cool rooms in Colorado. We love the Front Range.
Wherever it is, I sure hope I'm free that night and I'm going to block it off and make sure that I am.
Hell yeah. Yeah. Stay tuned. Follow at Grateful Drag and you'll see Bertha in your town soon. And you can find us. Ooh. We have videos on YouTube and it's fun. So that's kind of what I'm focusing on this year. And that was such a surprise. Like I Amazing. Never, if my band hadn't ended in 2020, if all that hadn't happened, if it hadn't like smacked me over the head with like, get your shit together. You're losing touch with the joy of music. If none of that had happened, I never would have started this. And I could never have imagined that I would have started a drag Grateful Dead cover band. But here we are, and it's so fun.
Yeah. Most improbable ideas are the best.
Hell yeah. Do it. Do the stupid thing. Do your worst idea.
Do your worst idea.
Do it.
Oh my God. Melody Walker, this was ridiculously fun. I can't thank you enough for spending some time with me and answering crazy personal questions and sharing your story. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
No one ever said crossing the River of Suck would be easy or that you had to do it alone. So I want to thank you for tuning in and giving it a chance. You can join the River of Suck swim team for just $1 a month or more if you have lots of money and you want to help art and podcasts exist. Sure appreciate you. Yeah, it's a Patreon website. Go check it out, riverofsuckswimteam.com. Thanks for tuning in. We've got more incredible guests coming, and we'll be back. Till next time,
keep swimming.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Oh, hey, you're still here? Awesome. I want to make sure you have subscribed to River of Suck in your favorite podcast app. Well, my original goal in 2018 was to release new episodes on a monthly basis. I have prioritized quality over sheer quantity, and new episodes can be released anytime. In 2022 and 23, I released 6 episodes per year. So make sure you're ready for the drop by subscribing where you listen or even following my YouTube channel, Skiing Fiddler. The River of Suck Swim Team Facebook group is still going strong, and it is a safe place for struggles. We'd love to see you over there. Don't forget to share your favorite episodes with your community, family, friends, and bandmates. If this episode was impactful for you, tell your friends. Also, coming up is another Fiddle Hell, filled with hundreds of workshops, concerts, and jams. April is online, so you can tune in from anywhere. And November is in person in Massachusetts. It's run by my family, and we always have a world-class lineup of artists to help you along the finer points of your musical path. And fun! So we'd love to see you there. And because I just can't end it any other way, till next time, keep swimming.